Two Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview Channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. I'd like to thank Peter Limbo for joining me as guest presenter while Tony is recovering from illness. Today, our guest is Charlie Farran. Peter was his manager during the Channel days. Welcome, Charlie.
And hello, Charles.
Excellent.
And I hope you enjoy this because he used to be your manager, you know.
Yeah, not only that, but Peter, do you still go out to spring training every year?
We stopped just a couple of years ago, but yeah, we went for about 10 or 11 years in a row.
Yeah, I just, you know, this time of year, I always start to get the bug because now they're talking about, you know, they're talking about the lineup and the roster, and they're already kind of getting started. And it's exciting. I think the Red Sox have made some good acquisitions, and hopefully they'll be in the running this year.
Well, you got to understand one thing, my friend. A, I love you to death, and B, I'm a Yankees fan.
There you go.
Well, I guess being a Yankees fan is pretty easy because they're always badass, you know. But yeah, I miss you, man, and I keep an eye on online. One of the great things about you know, the modern day is you can keep in touch with people online a little bit, at least spy it and see what they're up to, and I always kind of pay attention to your posts and YouTube, Dinky. You know, lot of cool stuff.
Well, we're here with Two Pints in a Corner, which is the Channel podcast. And the Channel podcast being a situation where we talk about good stuff, like how you played 25 times in, since 1985. But I see that you used to play in Balloon. Now, tell us about that. The first show you did was opening for Sass. Can you believe that? Sass on the...
Wow.
And that was... June 13th, 1980, with Balloon.
Did you say opening for Sass?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah, I remember that. It was at the Channel, and that's when the stage was in a different spot then.
Oh, that's right. It was Mad Hatter style.
That's right. It was Mad Hatter
style.
Yeah,
it was facing the other way. And it was like, wow, we're going to get a gig at the Channel. You know, that was like a big deal.
It changed. It changed when I come in because I took down that stupid roof that fell on Spinal Tap in the show.
Yeah, but I remember that. I remember that Sass gig. Sass was actually, they were actually a really good band. They had that brothers singing together thing, you know.
Yeah, there was a lot of good bands at that time. I wasn't around doing that. I was out with moms and papas at that time. And then they got me in 1984, but it was just such a good time for everybody in Boston when that place opened. You know, it was something so special that it's a scene. And most of the people, I mean, I see you were playing just about once a month, especially with Fahrenheit in 1985 on. And that once a month is like, you know, everyone, the Fools, the Stompers, everybody was doing that, which was good because it was entertaining. People were having a good old time.
The other great thing about the Channel was... it was a great place just to hang.
Yeah.
You know, I used to go there at night just to see anybody, you know, and goof off and
that's a good
have
point.
A drink.
That's a good point. Now, what do you think, Charlie, before you start talking about the playing side of it, what was the best night you ever went there to see someone different, to see someone like Roy Orbison, you know, things like that?
The Channel?
Yep.
Well, I, you know, when I was younger and just trying to get started, I went on every night. I had to see every band, and I had to see, you know, I studied. I was a real fan in high school, and once I decided to get into it, I would go and just study everything that every band did and learn from what they did well and from what they didn't do well. And I made a point to go out every night to see, you know, Rick Berlin's bands every time he played. And I wasn't working, I'd go to see Rick or the Fools or the Stompers or Butcher or, you know.
Oh, that's great education. They're great.
Celebration. You know, I'd look to see how they taped down their cables and where they stacked
Good on, Charlie. Good. Yeah.
I'd show up at sound check. so I could see them load in.
But the great thing about you doing all that stuff with the cables and stuff is you could teach Skillet how to do it correctly, you know?
Yeah. That was his, when he would hire a person for our crew, the first thing you'd see, you know how to wrap a cable? Yeah, okay, let me see you wrap a cable, you know?
Well, that channel stage knew how to have cables because there was tons and tons of gaffer's tape on that damn thing. And the only day it ever came off is when Gore was in there. They took everything off, cleaned everything, and nearly polished it. It was amazing. But
well, nowadays, there's much less cabling.
Oh, it's
nowadays,
all wireless.
There's a lot less cables on stage.
But you see, the thing is, the digital stuff takes away stuff. We humans don't hear digital. We hear analog. And your brain has to transfer that digital sound into analog. And a lot of it is the ones and zeros, so it farts a lot. And that's really the bottom line. So you could hit a note and you say, that's not duff, but it is, because it's the way the digital works. But if you're playing on your guitar like you did years and years ago, and still do, with a big old speaker in there, crank it to the max, boy, it sounds like a Stompers or a Charlie Farron at the channel, because you were loud, and good though, because that loud was flowing with the music and the air, and the channel loved that stuff, and the people that came to see you did. So
I saw a picture, I think recently, I don't know if you had posted it, but it was one of those big, 10 cabinets high, 8 cabinets wide PA system on each side of the stage. Remember those great big, that stand them on each side of the stage and they'd be 50 feet tall and, PA systems. And I just laughed. Those days were fantastic.
Well, I remember those days, Charlie, because somebody would get so messed up, they'd stick their head,
It was great.
And he'd sit, and some clown would sit there all night long with his head in the cowl, like, what are you, nuts?
I know. I watch where those guys are now.
The headbangers still do that. If you go over to Germany and play like you're doing now, and really crank it up, which you do on the big stages, they're doing the same thing. In plus, Germany, they've not lost that mentality of having ears bleed by the end of the night, kind of thing,
Well, I've been touring for the last 6 or 7 years, and almost all the bands are playing with silent stages now.
Yeah.
And with the exception of maybe Extreme, Joe Perry, I did some shows with Joe Perry a few years ago, and he's still playing through a whole pile of amps and really, really, really loud. And there's a lot to be said for that, but I can't stand it like I used to be when I was 19.
No, because you're playing more finesse stuff on the guitar, more flavor. And I understand.
Now they mic them off stage, and on stage there's hardly any sound now. Even like ZZ Top and Cheap Trick are not playing loud anymore. They have electronic ways of channeling their amp directly into the PA, and I don't know exactly how they do it, but even the drummers are using triggers a lot.
Yeah, well, that's what I did, especially with reggae in the 80s. We were doing that within a circle, it's triggering the drums rather than having just syndromes, which I was part of, and then mother drums that were around, we'd have trigger. And you have a D drum, and you hit the kick and stuff. It's, you feel so good.
Spoken like a true engineer.
Well, you've got to have the feeling from bottom end on your little toe all the way through your body without volume necessary, just the dynamic.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's all you really need. That's why you can make a human go to the bathroom. I've done that. Made them go to bathrooms easy. it's that kind of stuff where it's not the volume. I've done the loudest band in the world, Blue Cheer, at the time.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
They're awful. I put Peter Green in front of them. We had Fleetwood Mac in front of them in the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. And Peter nodded at me, and I ran back from the mixing console right straight onto stage and plugged every amplifier in on stage, and Peter took his 16 bass and let the place rip. And boy, it was twice as loud as anything that came on after that, and that was Blue Cheer. They were
the champion.
They were, supposedly, but there was one that came through the channel that nearly blew the doors off. And they were from Europe, and they just were so loud. it was not obnoxious because it was a full drone. You could hear the vocals because I had a separate vocal system at that time in the channel. And so it didn't have to use the PA, but they used the PA and subsidiary stuff just so they could get it louder than anything that any of this happened. And that went. A few panels went in the back room area, you know, before they started building an echo place. But
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's fun stuff, but you're right. If you're playing for an S, like you know, you are doing on opening for people right now, which is, I think is wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's great too.
Yeah, Peter, tell them what you were talking to me about.
Before we went on the air, I was just talking about you saying that you're America's opening act, and I said if you go back to the '80s, and if somebody, I don't know, did you come up with that yourself?
Well, you know. It was a little bit of a joke, and I was doing dates with REO Speedwagon, and Ken came in, and Dave Amato is the guitar player in that band, yeah. And he's one of the Worcester crowd,
yeah.
And so I knew him, and he told the guys all about, oh, Charlie's coming to do a, you know, a run of shows with us, and so Kevin came in to say hello. He goes, oh, great, Charlie, heard all about you. You're going to open for us on some dates, and I said, well, you know, I'm a little bit too old to be an opener. I think of myself more as a special guest. And he went, ah, that's funny, you know, and then he introduced me as America's special guest. And so I thought that was funny, and it kind of caught on, and, you know, now they don't have backdrops, they have projections.
Right.
Yeah,
and
the
next show I did, they had Ario, but Cheap Trick had America's special guest, Charlie Farris.
Well, there you go.
I like that.
I mean, I think that is just fabulous.
That's great stuff.
So it just caught on, you know, and people say, so would you open? And I said, well, I'll do it. I'll be the special guest. I said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, just... sounds more expensive. Doesn't cost sounds anything. Sounds like a better bill.
It certainly sounds more professional.
I like that one. Sounds more.
Yeah, it was just really started as a joke.
Wow.
So what was your favorite at the channel? What was your real favorite? I know now you've told me you've been seeing so many. I know where that's at, and it gets mind-boggling. But there's got to be one that kicked your butt big time that really said, that's what I like.
Well, I have always been very impressed with Extreme. And I was always impressed with Rick Berlin's groups. You know, I think, you know, you start doing this and you leave people out.
That's amazing.
I don't want to do that, but. I would always go and check out Rick's bands. I'd check out Butch's bands. I'd go to see Sal's bands. I didn't really, you know, we were working all the time too. So it wasn't like I would go out during the weekdays and see new bands playing. And that's the first time I saw, after I left the Joe Perry Project, when I left to do the Joe Perry Project, I remember Extreme was just starting with Nuno, and they were just getting going. And when I came back a couple of years later, back into the Boston scene, oh my God, they they had really turned into a good rock band. And I remember going to see them after the Joe Perry Project and just thinking, holy smokes, these guys really found themselves. So that's really one of the ones that really, really killed me. But when I was first coming up, I would go to see everybody that I thought was on the right trajectory. Mm. And I wanted to see what they were up to. And I remember going to see all those groups. I recently did an event with Joe Pett, and he was in a couple of Berlin's bands. And they were always, I always thought of them as the Boston's talking heads, you know.
Yeah.
They had that bad vibe to them.
Did. That's a good one. Joe Pett's really known.
I used to love watching him play.
Oh, man.
It's good. And, of course, the Fool's Bar was great. They never did the same show twice. They were always super.
See?
Thanks and I did some dates a few years ago with the Tubes. And they remind me so much of the Fools, you know.
You know, I'll tell you, I'll tell you a quick funny fool story. Tim Collins worked for Casperson and Peter Casperson in New York. And I had never met Tim. And the Fools and the Stompers did a benefit for WBCN when they went on strike. And here's Tim Collins walking around with his black velvet jacket on stage, giving orders to people. You know me well enough to know I don't pretty much acknowledge taking orders from somebody, especially some guy who was overweight and I didn't like him to begin with. So we had nothing but fights the entire show. And about 3 days later, I get a call from my lawyer at the time, Mason Daring from Marblehead, going, I want you to meet a friend of mine. I want you to meet Tim Collins. I'm like, Tim Collins? Boy, are you calling the wrong guy for the wrong... No, he's going to be at the music complex, and I want you two to go and have lunch and become friends. And as things would have it, Tim and I became best friends because of that.
Yeah.
And yet, I hated his guts the minute I met him.
Well, I mean, you know something? That's what it's about when you... trying to get yourself established, you bump into people who are also trying to get themselves established. I mean, you learn a lot from that whole experience, you know. Tim is doing really well now.
That's what I'm talking about.
You know, when Dinky asked me to do this, and I was thinking about you and how there were, maybe 6 or 8 real top-notch, you know, leaving Giles and the Cars out, 6 or 8 really top-notch Boston original bands, you know, and you couldn't go wrong with any one of them, you know, and I just thought about how rich this town was in talent, you know, and everybody had their own little corner of the world, but nobody really talked to each other, you know. Now I see Charlie playing with this guy and Sal playing with Butcher, and you know, and now all of a sudden everybody's sort of bonded together and everybody's friends. I wish it would have been like that back in the 80s and the early 90s, you know.
You know something though, it wasn't that we weren't friends, it's just that we were all vying for the same
you're right,
you know, the same spins on the radio or the same good
that
gigs
makes sense.
You know, and now we're all older, and I'm just happy to be considered, you know, among the survivors. and I'd like to think that there's still a robust scene in the clubs that's invisible to me because I don't go out like that anymore.
But there aren't that many clubs anymore like there were when, you know. I'll tell you one thing, man. To this day, if somebody asked me, and I'm going to ask myself so I can answer the question, who the best, blatantly the best songwriter was out of all of those people, I'm going to say two words, Charlie Farron. I think, honest to God, I think you wrote better quality songs. A lot of people had 3 great ones or 4 great ones or whatever. They did a couple of great covers to close the show that made people go nuts. You wrote quality music. Yes. And I would say that to anybody. You absolutely... I was telling Dinky this before we got on the air, but that song, Fool in Love, every time Fahrenheit sang that song, I cried. I would be in the back of a hall, wherever, alone, and that song absolutely then and now would absolutely bring me to tears. It was such an absolutely gorgeous, beautiful song.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I focused on, I focused on, instead of being a hotshot guitar player, I kind of focused on being a songwriting self-accompanist, you know. I still do, you know, that's still the thing that motivates me. And I love hotshot guitar players, but I really, really love the James Taylors and the Paul Simons and the Joni Mitchells.
There
you
go.
Sean Colvin. Some of these, you know, another one that I don't hear from too much anymore, who I thought was a fantastic solo guitar playing singer, was Jonathan Edwards.
Definitely. I did work with Jonathan.
I saw him play, and I was so blown away by his command of guitar and voice and audience you know, control.
And he's still out there doing it.
Really, really strong.
There was him, but there was also giving you a different. Around that time was Martin Mull, and Martin could do some good stuff, but because I did Jonathan Edwards and I did Eric Anderson, you know, all those guys that were solos like that. And but you're right, I think that he did the better one out of them all, but they still had their own flavors, every one of them.
You know, I went when speaking about Jonathan Edwards, when Tim Collins was managing Jonathan before Joe Perry and Aerosmith and all that nonsense, he and I went to see Jonathan play, and I actually met one of the zombies who was working for CBS at the time, and my brother being the biggest zombie fan in the world, I tried to get an autograph and not be too outrageous, but I didn't make it. But the funniest thing was there was this lawyer named Paul Schindler who was there, and Tim was trying to get him to sign Jonathan Edwards and shop a deal for him. And for some odd reason, Schindler and I ended up becoming best friends, and he became my lawyer but not Tim's, and it was all because of Jonathan Edwards. So, you know, he has a place in my heart.
And that's great.
And Paul was the guy that got, you know, two of my people signed and put me in touch with the late, great Richie Cordell, who was the craziest human being that God ever put in the face of the earth. And I look back at all this now, man, and I look at you, how you stayed sane, had children, raised a family, married a lovely woman, and still kept your sanity is beyond me. Yeah. But God bless you, my son.
I don't know about the kept the sanity part.
We're talking of...
We have seven grandchildren now.
Oh my God.
Golly. Wow.
Boy, you really are old. Never mind. I'm going home.
We have, and sometimes three of them live in, with my daughter who lives in Nevada. But when she comes, she stays with us with her three kids. And then my daughter from Nashua, New Hampshire, has four kids. And all of them are over my house for that whole week.
Oh, that's great stuff.
Oh, my
that's
God.
Great stuff, Granddad. I love it. I mean, we have a 16-year-old.
So you really are a fool in love, then, actually, coming back to the original thought process.
You know, you mentioned Martin Mull, and I saw Martin Mull perform with his Fabulous Furniture.
Oh, do
you
remember that?
Oh, Jesus.
I thought he was so funny, you know.
It's great. That's why I mentioned him, because
he's great. And he played guitar and sang songs, and one of the songs was a blues tune. You know, I woke up this afternoon, and one of my two Porsches was gone.
Yeah. One of my two Porsches.
Oh, my God.
I've got a request here. Because Tony's not with us, Tony Raine, I'd like to hear what you did with Tony. I had a good time with Tony at the Channel, because he was a really good general manager at that time and running around and helped every artist he could possibly do with what was going on. What were your thoughts on Tony there?
Well, you know, my involvement with the Channel was really from really mostly the bands and crew perspective. I know of Tony and I know Tony, but I don't really know him well. And he was kind of working on a plane that was not visible to me. I was focused on what was happening on stage always. So I know that the management changed, and I wasn't really aware of those eras as they came and went, as to, you know, the management team at the Channel.
You were just focusing on the personnel regarding the production and stuff.
Yeah, I was. I mean, you know, I went to, after high school, I went 1 year to college, and I saw a band playing on our campus, a local group, and boy, they sounded good, and I thought, my band doesn't sound like that. What am I doing here? I need to be learning how to do that. Yeah. That's what I want.
Excellent, Charlie. Yep.
And I just felt like, you know, the best school in the world is the world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to tell you something. And I don't think I've ever heard you talk like this in all the years that I've known you. But you think the way you write songs, You think so methodically. The way you're talking now about going out and seeing other bands,
yeah.
What I did right, what they did wrong, what I'm going to do right, what I'm going to do wrong. You write very similarly to that. You write in a very logical, methodical way. You write brilliantly. As I said, I think you have written the best songs to come out of Boston in terms of quality. And I don't know. It's just something that I think is inbred there in the Farron family because, I don't know, it blows me away.
I certainly appreciate you saying that, but...
That's your old manager saying something really more than the manager would do.
You know what? How could you help but fall in love with your songs? I just don't...
There you go.
I don't know how anybody other than some gangbang metalhead could not understand what it is that you write about. And certainly,
well,
if you've ever been in love or you've ever cared for somebody, you've got to totally appreciate how you write songs and how you perform.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll have to send you some of my latest stuff.
I'd love to hear.
Because I have working right now. I have two songs I'm working on right now. And my latest thing is I'm recording them with a single guitar track and a single vocal track. So it's just guitar and voice. And with no harmonies, no other instruments. And because that's the way I perform. And I thought I'll just try and write songs that work really well that way. But, you know, one of the funniest things, when one of the opportunities that we had was to open for Mad Angel at the Kenmore Club at Katie's. And I think it was for 2 weeks, you know, 7 nights a week. And I think it was 2 weeks in a row. And we opened for them. And I was always really in awe of them. They had their act really together at the time. And Jimmy D'Angelo was like kind of the rock star of that band. And, I remember saying to him, Jimmy, you know, who cut your hair? How do you get your hair like that? And where do you get your clothes? You know? And he says, oh, my hair, I just look in the mirror and cut off chunks.
That's a haircut. I like that one.
Oh my God.
And the clothes, I just go and shop at the women's department. And I thought, oh, brilliant. Genius. You know, you just would get those kind of flowy tops, and you know, he was like a big influence on me early in my career.
Except you had to go to the big and tall shop because being 8'6", you know,
large ladies. But anyway, that's how you learn. You just learn by observation and adventure.
Well, it's funny you talk about learning by observation. You know, when I first decided I was going to get into the music business, I kind of learned with a cover band that used to rehearse at the Music Complex, and that sort of gave me an idea of how this thing all works. And I can remember years later, I was managing Mighty Sam McClain and Weepin' Willie Robinson.
And oh, God, I remember.
I was at the Channel upstairs. And I was in a suit and tie.
Yeah, that's you.
And I forget the manager's name, God rest his soul. But he came up to me and he goes, are you Tim Collins' chauffeur? I always see you that's with good. Tim. And I was like, you know. I was like, well, no, not actually. But, you know, I am responsible for this. In a way, I am responsible for the sold-out crowd here on a Saturday night in Harvard Square. But, you know,
I remember you were one of the first guys I knew who had an early cell phone.
Yeah, I had the first bag phone. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I remember thinking like, "Wow, the future is here."
I can remember
nobody had.
Nobody had them. Tim Collins finally got one, but he got the small, like the radio, looked like a World War II radio thing.
Yeah.
But I can remember the first or second day I had that phone, it was like $3 a minute for incoming or outgoing calls. I'm in the North End with Nance Greenspan, who said hello, by the way. I talked to her today. We're walking down the street on our way to dinner, and she said, "Wow, can I call my mother?" And I said, "Yeah, but just say hello." When I tell you that we walked from one end of the North End to the other, that was about a $58 telephone call. When I'm only going to say hi, you know. She said, "You're not going to believe this, but we're walking down Hanover Street, and I'm talking on Peter's cell phone."
The kids today would not appreciate how wild that was when that started happening.
Well, you know, I guess in my life anyways, I tried to stay ahead of the curve if I could, you know.
You did for sure.
I can remember, you know, years later in the 90s when I sort of got pushed back into the business after wanting to get away from it. A lawyer friend of mine came and said, "I just met this guy, Mighty Sam McClain, and he wants me to be his lawyer, but I had to get him out of the Somerville jail. But I think you might want to meet him." I'm like, "Really? I want to meet some guy who's been in jail that you had to bail out." So I went and had lunch with him at the Newbury Steakhouse. Now, he seemed like a nice guy. He was from Louisiana. I knew nothing about him. I ended up walking back to John Messina's studio by Fenway Park. I go upstairs, and he has his big screen TV on. This has got to be, I'm guessing, 91 or something, maybe. And we're watching the Channel 4 news, and they're interviewing men on the street about busing. And it's to us, they find this heavy-set black dude, all dressed in black, hanging on the corner. And the guy goes up to him and says, "Sir, how do black people feel about busing in Boston?" Now, Sam's only been in Boston for 3 weeks, and he spent a week of it in the Somerville jail. So, I mean, he knows nothing about it. And I'm saying to John Messina, "That's the guy I just had lunch with." And he's going, "What?" And I'm saying to myself, this is kismet. I was meant to work with this guy. And then, of course, we ended up headlining festivals in Europe, and I had never been to Europe. And, you know, I just remember landing in Belgium and having him crying on my shoulder, trying to get through security, going, "Everybody's promised to do this, and I can't believe I'm finally here," thinking that I had been to Europe many times, and it was my first time there, too. So, but it's a weird business.
It's fun, though.
Still a client, yeah.
It's a life business. I mean, there's not, even though Peter says he's out of it, he's still talking about it because that was the fun times and yet very hard times, too. We all went through this.
I told Dinky the story. My brother, who's sitting here with me, was the senior counsel and vice president of Northeastern University, and I used to hang around there and go to hockey games and stuff like that. And they finally said, "Hey, we're going to start doing concerts at the arena. Why don't you come in and help us out?" And I said, "All right, why not? I'm sitting on my ass doing nothing, you know." And I can just remember talking to these people who I'd known for years by going into the hockey and basketball games and with my brother, and now I'm working with them. And they all want to ask me questions about my life because they knew me when I was, like everybody else in the music business, half out of my mind. And I can remember sitting down, we'd go out somewhere for a beer or something after work, and I'd have to give everybody the C, D, and E versions of these stories. Because if I ever really told them the A and B versions, they would absolutely kick my ass on the street.
Fun stuff. Fun stuff. Yeah, we're going to laugh at you, Charlie. So anyway, before we end this little podcast here for, what is it, 45 minutes or something like that, it's been fun. And have you got any more questions on there that you want to talk about?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I just have to, just sit down and say, you know, I love your music. I love just about everything you've done. Someday I wanted you to write a book about what it was like being on the road with Joe Perry, though, and Doc McGrath. God rest his soul.
You've got some souls here. some really nice stories in that place.
Because I heard the band stories once, and then I would hear Tim Collins' version, the Steve Barrasso's versions of the stories, and it was just amazing how different those stories were.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't really involved that long when Tim came on board, but Don Law was on there. Was Joe's man?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
When I was with him, and those those were wild days. Joe was in a pickle at the time, and the experience reflected that. But I've done shows, more recently with Joe in the last couple of years, and he's still Joe. I mean, he's still the same guy.
But you know what?
He doesn't seem like he's in that pickle anymore at all.
That's great. Good news. God bless him. I mean, he was one hell of a talented guy. He really was.
He really is, yeah. And he's a noisy, crazy punk rock guitar player, but boy, does he write those songs, and he really does write those great riffs, and I mean, that can't be taught,
the riff king of the world.
It really is.
The thing that's interesting with Joe is that he really loved my old guitarist, Peter Green. He absolutely
loved. I love Peter Green.
Yes, I loved him very much. I mean, I worked with him from 1968 through 1970, when Peter and I both left together, kind of thing, and I joined the Birds, and he joined the airspace, and unfortunately they didn't do a good job in the hospital with him. But Peter, every night when I, whether it be a pub or a giant arena or wherever, his playing, his emotion, his feeling every night was second to none. It was unbelievable. And I wish you'd have seen him live, Charlie, because let me tell you, when we played the Tea Party here, we blew everybody in town away, and that was
amazing. I believe it. He was really something. And you know who else? You probably might know, and it was actually at the House of Blues, and it was actually the Joe Perry gig. I met Terry Reid.
Oh, yeah, Terry's good.
And he was from that era, too, and boy, what a great singer.
Yeah,
and so I got that. I was going to go up and do three songs with the band, and Terry was going to come up and do a song or two with the band. And so while we're waiting to walk on and do our 10 minutes apiece, we got to hang out in the dressing room for a long, long time. And that was really fun to kind of chat with him. And he was like a cool underground hero for me when I was like in high school. And all the guitar players I knew, all the, the guys who were a little bit older than me were just crazy about Terry Reid, and that was really cool to meet him.
It's the White Boy Blues stuff. Terry and Stan Webb from Chicken Shack, all those characters that came along were so good at what they're doing emotionally, because they just let it out from the heart. And every note, that's why Peter plays so many less notes than Eric Clapton did. And when
he was great though. We used to do Oh Well. We used to do Green Man Alishi.
Oh, you don't know what that's about.
We used to do his version of Black Magic Woman.
Yeah,
back.
Well, one day, Carlos Santana actually was the first time he ever came to England on a CBS tour with I think it was Taj Mahal and a couple other people. They're playing Albert Hall. We'd asked him, because we met him in San Francisco, we asked him, do you want to come in and join us? We were making an album called Then Play On. And, we got in there, he came in the studio, and Peter said, was actually just playing doodles on Black Magic Woman. And then he really went nuts on that. And then that happened, that he pulled his guitar out, and for 2.5 hours, they jammed in the studio playing everything. So Carlos learned Black White Magic Woman in so many different ways and styles that Peter put on, but just straight blues from the heart. And he took it and loved it, and that's what he did, a real good job on it. And we've had a few like that. And we used to be able to go in them days out to people's house, like Grateful Dead stuff. We'd go over there when we were in California. Janis was an old friend of ours and stuff, and her band were just unbelievable stuff that we could get into with different sounds. Barry Melton and his guitar with his Fender and his Twin and the old light in the back as a power soak. We put a 110 volt light in his back of his amplifier, and let him play like that. Just really amazing sounds that Barry used to get, you know, and we loved it. That's Country Joe stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And then, as I said earlier on one of these earlier podcasts, I mentioned that when we came with Fleetwood at one point, we played in Houston, and these young lads came over to see us, and they wanted us to go back afterwards and jam with them. And they've been doing this with every English act that came through. Eric did it and umpteen others. So Peter and Danny and I said, I'll go with you. And we went over to these guys' house. And these guys' house had been playing for about a year, if not more, together and jamming in the house. And they eventually...
You should write a book.
I did do it in 1989.
We had this conversation about an hour ago, Charlie. I just found out that Dinky wrote a book myself.
And then just to stop it, these young lads were eventually called ZZ Top. And so we...
Yeah, wow, you know, Jesus.
And then they've been friends of Mick and John, actually Mick more than John, because they love what he does and he works with them and stuff. And my old tour manager, Chris Adamson, went out and took them out the last time to come to Russia, actually. And you're right, they're playing on little amplifiers and this, that and the other, but it's such a nice job. it's really good, you know. But anyway, that's my side of things. But you see, I always went with guitarists. I moved from Peter Green to Clarence White, unbelievable guitarist, unbelievable with the bend of the sounds. I used to get the Leslie going around in the room, swirling around for live for the birds. Wasn't Born to Follow. You would follow the motorbike right across with the guitar and stuff. And then I had John McLaughlin. I had Mahavishnu Orchestra for 2 years. And that was all me in the beginning, in the 1973, when they first started and stuff. And I first came out in 72 with Mahavishnu when one of the first dates they did at Lennox with me, with my new sound system. I built a music reproduction system. Yeah, you played in the same system, but you didn't play with the mixers I built. The DBX mixers, because nobody would understand how to operate them because there's no numbers on the knobs.
The first time I saw Aerosmith was at the Kenmore Club, and nobody was there. There was about 30 people there.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had two voices in the theater. They played on the floor.
Yeah.
And there's no stage, and they had two voices in the theater cabinets.
Yeah.
And the mixer was four. Do you remember those Shure?
Sure, four channel jobs, yeah.
I think they had four volume knobs.
Yeah.
Right? And then I think they had three of them, and that was the mixing console. No, just volumes.
Yeah, can you imagine?
That was what I did with Fleetwood Mac when we first started. Peter used to take the mixer on stage. It was a Selma, same thing, but a two amplifier mixer. On the side of a stage on a chair, and there'd be four knobs on there with four mics, and we only really used three at that time when they first joined them. And Peter did it himself. No monitors, no nothing, just blasted out.
Nope, I remember that. I've done many shows with no monitors in my early life.
And you learn how to sing even better with no monitors. You don't necessarily need the earplug when you start getting weird sounds. You use your hearing naturally, and that's the whole thing of live sound. That's the whole beauty of it, the emotion that you can feel on a guitar, the emotion you can feel in your notes that you sing out of your mouth and stuff that you're giving from the heart. And that's what you've been doing, Charlie, for all the time I've ever heard.
If there was ever a guy from this town who sang from the heart, it's Charlie Farron.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's why I don't think, I don't know, I'm not sure you could ever hear a bad word about you, either in your conduct, in your outlook, in your performance, in your vocals, your songwriting. I mean, I hate to say you were the perfect singer, songwriter, musician, but you might have been. And maybe you still are.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Peter. You know, I love that, and I love that you'll say that. I'm sure there are people who have other opinions, but I hope there's not too many of them. So I appreciate that so much, Peter. It's great.
Well, you know what? You kept your ego in your pocket. And that was a hard thing to do back then because, as much as it was competition about getting a record deal or getting the headline weekend to get the channel, whatever it was, it was all about ego. And as you know, I dealt with some people who had egos that were not particularly affectionate. And unlike most of those people, you were just Charlie Farron.
Yeah.
I mean, you were a pleasure to work with. Everybody loved you. And you wrote great songs. And I don't know. I guess I'm just a fool in love.
There you go.
That's so
okay,
exciting.
Charlie, I'm going to have to say thank you for being on Two Pints in the Corner with the channel and stuff, and with our presenter, our guest presenter, Peter Limbo, and our guest sideman, Vinny Limbo, sat over here, and my wife, Nancy, sat in the corner. It's just been entertaining.
It's kind of like Two Pints in the Corner over here.
That's exactly what it is. Well, you know, that's what happens when old people get, not old people, but anybody gets to, well, you know, gets together at night. They'll have a drink of beer and a pint and start chatting about all these stories. And by the end of the night, you're trashed and have it, without knowing it, on one pint of beer because you got so high from the stories. And that's what the whole process of this, same with the podcast. We get high on what the momentum is on this podcast. We're remembering the channel. We're remembering Boston in the 80s, 90s, and now in 25. Oh, my God.
Amazing.
It's amazing. It's amazing. But think of the time and construction of everything. And that's what you've done, and you've followed it through, and you've got a pattern that that works with us. All of us are doing the same thing. We've got a pattern that really works. But when something like this comes along, you go, oh, let's have some fun and stuff.
I tell you, what Dinky and Tony have put together, after I listened to my own nonsense on the podcast,
good one, Peter.
We had a good time. We had a great time. But I went back to listen to a few of the other people that I knew.
Oh, God.
And I'm like going, you know, you just, A, you forget things, and then B, all of a sudden you think of one thing and it starts this flood of stuff that you just go,
I remember that.
And, you know, my current wife, we've been together for 10 years, she didn't know me back in the day. And unfortunately, she sat through my interview with Dinky and Tony, and she managed to laugh it off. I was very surprised.
To start turning down stuff, we're starting to get crackles from phones. Are you there, Charlie?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well,
listen to these guys.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for everything.
For having me, this conversation has been a blast, and it's great to reconnect with you, Peter. I miss you, and we'll have to get together and grab some lunch.
Same here, Charlie. I would love to do that. I'm retired, and I'm at your beck and call, my friend.
Excellent. Thank you, Charlie, and we'll see you. There's Two Pints in the Corner, signing out.
Okay. My best to Tony, too. Thanks.
Thank you.